Surveys and polls are in the news, not on the presidential campaign, but on the rise of e-books in the U.S. and the rest of the world. The French and the Japanese have something in common, it turns out. While in Brazil and India, two of the so-called BRICS group of developing nations, the size of the e-book marketplace is set to double and triple nearly overnight. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show, as always, from his office in Manhattan is Andrew Albanese, PW's Reviews Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris. Great to be here as always.
Well, it's good to have you back with us and always bringing us more news from the ebook marketplace, and the data just keeps rolling in. I guess on Monday's issue, you're going to have a report on two studies out, one from Belker and another from the Pew Center.
Well, that's right. You know, it's probably not going to surprise anyone listening to us that ebooks are growing and growing rapidly. In Monday's issue, we're going to have a look at, as you say, two new surveys that actually put some numbers to that growth. So one of them is the Belker Market Research Global Ebook Monitor, which we call the GEM study, Global Ebook Monitor. And that looks at international markets for ebooks. And the other is a Pew Internet and American Life study, which looks exclusively at the United States. So what are the big takeaways? Well, internationally, this will probably not surprise anyone either, but the world still lags behind the U.S., but it is catching up pretty quickly as new ebook platforms and products start to make their way to market in these other territories. As it stands now, Australia, India, the U.K., and of course the U.S. are leading the world in ebook adoption rates. And as you mentioned in your intro, France and Japan do have something in common. They're bringing up the rear. These two countries had respondents that were the least likely to say that they purchased an ebook. Overall, more than 20% of respondents reported purchasing ebooks in the last 6 months in the Belker study. And the study revealed that the market for ebooks is poised for a pretty rapid increase in Brazil and in India. Over 50% of the respondents to this survey said from Brazil and India said that they were going to buy an ebook in the next 6 months. That prediction would, as you mentioned, immediately double and triple the number of ebook buyers in Brazil and India. You know, India is a very interesting case, by the way, because, you know, first of all, it's an English-speaking country. It's highly tech-focused, and it has a massive population, about 1.2 billion. And they, from the survey, they certainly appeared to like ebooks and to want ebooks. But what's holding them back for now is the country is not terribly wired. There's a lack of web access in a lot of the country, and there's also, you know, literacy issues, I'm told. But you know, only about 10% of the country is online right now. So when that picks up in the next decades, you're going to certainly see a very literate ebook market surging online there. So in the United States, the results from the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project showed that ebook consumers, this is my big takeaway anyway, ebook consumers are reading about a third more books than their print-only customers. According to this report that was released yesterday, the average reader of ebooks says he or she has read 24 books in the past year, compared with an average of 15 books by non-ebook consumers. But print is still very much in the mix, according to the Pew survey. 88% of those who read an ebook in the past year also recorded reading a print book. And overall, in the past year, 72% of adult respondents reported reading a print book. On the other hand, 21% say they've read an ebook. Now, that 21% figure is still pretty good, considering where ebooks were just a couple of years ago. And that's also up 4 points over December of 2011, when only 17% reported having read an ebook. So reading ebooks, whether you're ready or not, it's surging, and get ready for more growth in the coming months.
Well, you know, I think that's fascinating news, Andrew, in particular the news coming from Brazil and India. And I would imagine that the ebooks they're reading will not be on an iPad. They'll be reading those ebooks on phones, which is something that publishers ought to be thinking about.
Absolutely.
Well, you were uptown a couple of times in recent days, joining us at the Columbia Law School Kernikin Center, as well as being there earlier in the week for a talk by Robert Darnton. Tell us about those.
That's right. I've been spending a little time at Columbia in the past past week or so. So first of all, I want to say congratulations to CCC on another great On Copyright event. You know, I've been to every one of these since they began, and I've always been entertained and I've always been educated. All of them have been fantastic. And speaking personally, I just want to say what I really appreciate most is the even-handed, sort of all sides of the conversation approach that CCC takes in hosting these events. I think it's hard to find that sometimes in the copyright debate these days. It tends to be a polarized debate, but certainly not at these events. I think they're just outstanding. So I want to say congrats to you. And my takeaway, or in a word, I should say, the lack of a word, my big takeaway was that the word piracy really didn't crop up that much this year. In past years, you know, I feel like there's been a lot more talk when we talk about copyright about ways to fight piracy and, you know, the rampant scourge of piracy. But at this year's On Copyright, I found the conversation really to be very focused on sort of serving consumers, a real focus on giving consumers what they want when they want it, and also a pretty good focus on the needs of creators. You know, I think each event has stood as a bookmark, sort of in the or benchmark, I should say, in the maturation of the digital market. But I felt like this year was a real step forward in terms of the market, and not surprising given the momentous changes we've seen since the last event in 2010. A few highlights I'll mention. I thought musician Erin McCune was incredibly engaging, and she really sort of pointed out the tension facing creators. At one point, she said that she really doesn't want to sue anybody, but really, when it comes to copyright, there often isn't any other choice. You know, I think that's spot on, and I would agree there needs to be a better range of solutions than those provided by lawyers when it comes to the copyright issue. I also found the conversation in the morning that revolved around the failure of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, to be rather disappointing. You know, I felt the panelists kind of glossed over some of the more odious measures of the bill, especially the way the bill was written, sort of behind closed doors. And at one point, I remember the speaker from Paramount suggested that the bill was badly named. And overall, the panel seemed to think SOPA's one of SOPA's biggest problems was that its aims were poorly articulated. You know, I kind of found that to be, well, almost delusional, because communication was really not the problem with SOPA, in my opinion anyway, and I want to express that that's my opinion. But certainly we're not done with this issue of sort of updating copyright for the digital age. But I think if we're going to do this, we really need to sort of get real about what's going to work. One of the keynoters, Robert Levine, was extremely entertaining. It was a bit glib at times. He was sort of performing, I thought, but still really very engaging. And I really think he nailed it at one point when he said that he didn't need copyright for 70 years after his death, but a few months of not having his book pirated would be nice. I think that's a pretty strong observation. Yes, copyright might last too long. Yes, it might cover up, cover too much. But, you know, it's also very difficult to enforce. You know, and all this goes back to something Bill Patry told me in an interview in PW earlier this year, that when laws become out of balance and become disregarded, you're in real trouble. And I wonder if maybe that's happened with some people in regards to copyright, you know, that they're just not respecting copyright, that piracy seems to be, you know, common and unenforceable because, you know, maybe they feel the copyright's tipped out of balance. I'm not sure that's the case, but I thought it was a really interesting observation made by Levine. And last, and what I thought was best, Maya Thomas, the director of digital from Hachette, I felt like she was pretty refreshingly candid on the things that she said, especially on the DRM issue. And in fact, Thomas echoed what Cory Doctor wrote about in last week's PW and what we talked about on the podcast, that, you know, DRM really doesn't stop piracy on ebooks, and that maybe ebooks would be better off without DRM because that would at least serve as a counter to the lock-ins that retailers like Amazon are now able to enforce. You know, I don't expect Hachette to be following that line of thinking anytime soon and removing DRM from their ebooks, but I think it was nice to hear that from Maya Thomas, because perhaps it's at least in discussion in the boardrooms. And I'm wondering, since I've got you here, Chris, what maybe your impressions of the CC event were?
Well, first of all, Andrew, thank you for your kind words. I mean, my impression was that it was really, as you say, a comprehensive look at the state of the art today in 2012. And for all of that, I'm going to dodge the question about my own personal impressions, but suggest everybody find out for themselves what went on. We have all the program on streaming video at a website that is appropriately on copyright 2012. That's on copyright2012.com, and you can see all the videos there. You can check out what people were tweeting and hashtag on copyright, and there's even a LinkedIn group where the conversation is ongoing. I think that's the point. We've held three of these now every other year since 2008, and as you pointed out, the whole scene has done nothing but continue to evolve, and we're really very happy to sort of chart that for people. And finally, I want to just call out by name the organizer here at CCC of the program, put all of the pieces together, Joanna Murphy Scott, who did such a terrific job, and she worked closely with the people at the Kernighan Center on that. And that takes us back to the Kernighan Center, where you saw Bob Darden.
That's right. On Monday, I went back for a talk by Harvard University librarian Robert Darden, who made a little bit of news, I think, by vowing that the Digital Public Library of America, which is a nonprofit and nationwide effort to digitize and offer access to millions of free digitized books and special collections, would absolutely launch by April of 2013. And that's no small feat. So I certainly hope that that comes to pass. Darden made these remarks as the featured speaker at the 25th annual Horace Mangius Lecture, which was hosted by, as you say, the Kernighan Center for Media and Arts at Columbia. The whole lecture was great. It was an hour-long lecture. It offered a real fascinating look at the history of copyright and the book trade, dating back to its roots in Europe through the founding fathers, the building of the libraries of America, and the recent travail surrounding Google's digitization plan, which Darden ultimately ended up opposing rather vigorously. So the primary tension of today, Darden noted, was between democratization and commercialization. Now, he acknowledged that commercial interests certainly need to be respected. But the issue today, he noted, in an age when we have the ability and the technology to offer this broad access to culture, is how we find equilibrium. You know, the Google scam plan is a good case in point. Darden pointed out that the program began as a great idea that offered access to like millions of books to people who would otherwise never have it. But in its ultimately failed legal settlement, it became more of a commercial library with no real public oversight, no real public purpose. As for the DPLA, Darden said the steering committee, which I think has about 20 members, was wrestling away with the issues of getting the project going. And he did note that copyright-related issues were the biggest challenge they faced. Notably, he said, he thought the DPLA should steer clear of books that were currently in the marketplace. Now, I don't know, and he didn't say that was the view of the steering committee at large, but it just sounds like it was too complicated an issue for them to get involved with. He also thought that they should have opt-ins and opt-outs for authors. And he also mentioned that we're going to need some sort of congressional solution if we're going to include the millions of out-of-print and orphan works. Now, I know the Copyright Office has said orphan works legislation is a priority. And in fact, Michelle Wood of the Copyright Office voiced that at the On Copyright seminar the previous Friday. But still, I wonder, I don't see that that's happening anytime soon. If for no other reason, then the principals who would need to get together in a room to make this happen seem to be focused more on the books and products they have now that are actually making money in the digital realm rather than those books that are out of print and moldering on library shelves. I don't know that there's enough legislative momentum, going to push this through at least anytime soon. But I hope I'm wrong.
Well, time will tell, and we appreciate your reports from on campus there. You've been up at Columbia Law School. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, thanks so much for that. And I want to turn now to Mike Harfke, who is PW's Deputy Reviews Editor. Michael, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thanks. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and it's a delight to have you join us this week. And you know, I understand I looked into your background. You're related to Clyde Barrow.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's a bit of a family mythology, but I've been looking into it. And, you know, my grandfather was Buck Barrow. I grew up in Missouri. Clyde and his family spent some time there. And my grandfather was named after Clyde's brother and is, in fact, a descendant. I think it's a distant cousin.
Well, you know, I don't know if the Barrows look at it this way, but would Clyde have been anything if it weren't for Bonnie?
I don't know. I mean, she was, you know, I always think of Faye Dunaway, you know, and I think in reality she was nothing like that, but probably not. You know, behind every good Robin Hood-like criminal is a strong, silent woman, you know.
Well, or at least, you know, she spoke softly but carried a
big
pistol.
Gatling gun.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's turn to the review of the reviews that you do, Mike, and tell us, where are we starting?
Well, this week's issue features a new set of the PW Select reviews and listings, the self-published quarterly that we've been doing. This one includes a profile of the self-published author Matt Ivester about his book LOL OMG, which is a handbook for students about managing online reputation, citizenship, and cyberbullying. Beyond that,
a timely title.
Absolutely, and it really stood out actually among the crop of the largest crop yet of submissions that we got for PW Select. And beyond that, in fiction, this week we've got a starred and boxed review for the Agriculture Hall of Fame with the University Press, and this is a short story collection by Andrew Mallon Millward, a Kansas native and a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Always a good thing. We say that, you know, these are very sensitively drawn tales that evoke the prairie life in a purposefully muted canvas, making a very colorful cast of characters stand out that much more. A very different thing. Harry Sidebottom is back with The Caspian Gates, book 4 of the Warrior of Rome series. Sidebottom remains consistently meticulous about detail, old-fashioned about storytelling, and very astute in portraying the political backstabbing worthy of the modern era. It's a very fun read. And another fun read is the Meryl Streep Movie Club, which we call an impossibly romantic debut by Mia March, about a woman who runs a B&B in Maine, summoning the three girls that she raised there, her daughter and two nieces, back home for some Meryl Streep movie-fueled healing, because this woman has been diagnosed with cancer. All three women, from ranging from 25 to 31 years old, are dealing with traumas of their own, and the whole book is structured around the films of Meryl Streep, her entire oeuvre.
Well, there's something of a loose connection to be found in your Q&As this week.
Yeah, that's right. In fiction, we talked to English author Sadie Jones. She has a new novel called The Uninvited Guests, which is set in an Edwardian country house called Stern, that's really thrown into disarray by the unexpected and certainly unwanted arrival of several people whose train is derailed nearby. In our starter review in the March 19th issue, we called the book a remarkable dark comedy, and we think, though it may draw comparisons to Downton Abbey, and is a charming book, Jones is getting at something more serious by having the entire novel unfold over the course of a single day, April 30th. The day that follows is May Day, or International Workers' Day, and that becomes very significant. And ties in nicely with the nonfiction Q&A, which we have with Linda Hirschman, a former labor lawyer and current political columnist, about her book Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, in which she traces the surprising, inspiring arc of the gay rights struggle. We also talked to British crime writer S.J. Bolton about Dead Scared, which is her follow-up to last year's Now You See Me. It's a series featuring the feisty but damaged heroine Detective Constable Lacey Flint, who this time goes undercover at Cambridge University to investigate a series of suspicious suicides. And that leads us nicely into the thriller mystery category in reviews. This week, we think British author Elizabeth Haynes' debut, Into the Darkest Corner, is a riveting psychological portrait of one woman's life on two different time paths as she contends with the handsome, charming man who insinuates himself into her life. We call this a terrifying and convincing portrayal of an abusive relationship. We also review the reissue of a bestseller, Justin Scott's The Ship Killer, a nautical thriller first published in 1978. In this one, a yachtsman vows revenge after the world's largest supertanker collides with his boat, unfortunately killing his wife. And in this case, Clive Cussler, Scott's co-author on The Thief, provides a new preface.
You've also got in that same category a signature review from a well-known mystery author.
Yeah, that's right. Charles Finch. His novel, Death in the Small Hours, will be out later this year in November. And he begins his signature review of Alex Grecian's The Yard with, quote, a hunt for anachronisms because of something he finds in the book. Very interesting. Elsewhere in sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, we've got reviews of Prepare to Die! Exclamation point, by Paul Tobin. And we think it's a terrific deconstruction of the superhero story. It's full of fierce action, sexy romance, warm nostalgia, and wry observations on being a superhero in the age of YouTube. Peter F. Hamilton's Manhattan in Reverse is a pleasantly surprising short fiction turn for an author better known for his enormous doorstopper sci-fi epics. Seriously, this guy rarely brings it in under 700 pages, and it's getting close to 1,000 in some cases. So many of the stories tie into his longer works, making this, we feel, a good gateway drug for new readers.
And we're not highlighting any specific horror review that will appear in the issue. You do have a special feature on the 2012 World Horror Convention.
Yeah, that's right. This was just last weekend, and our senior reviews editor, Peter Cannon, attended the convention in Salt Lake City. And we've got his report on the highlights and a big horror feature about the event that was held, quote, at the Mountains of Madness, which is the event's tagline. They took it from an H.P. Lovecraft novel. So that's really interesting. And Peter was on the floor and has a lot to say about it. Moving on to romance, we've got Nalini Singh's Tangle of Need, in which she continues her consistently excellent Psy Changeling series with a romance between two shapeshifters who know one thing for certain, which is that they are not each other's fated mates. So the destined eternal partner trope is very popular in paranormal romance right now, and Singh has a really fascinating take on it here, we think. Elsa Watson's Dog Days is a charming canine take on the Freaky Friday genre, in which a woman who hates dogs but loves a veterinarian swaps minds with a stray German shepherd. It's fun and funny with a PG-rated love story and smart poetic justice at the end.
Well, in the nonfiction reviews, a number of familiar names pop up from politics to pop music.
Yeah, they really do. We've got It Worked for Me, In Life and Leadership by Colin Powell, writing with Tony Koltz. It's a plain-spoken, half-memoir, half-leadership manifesto from the former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There's a lot of inspirational sense here, drawn from Powell's matchless range of managerial and political experiences. However, there's also a frustrating reticence on the great leadership crisis of his time, the Iraq War. We have a starred review of My Cross to Bear, which is written by Greg Allman and with a music journalist, Alan Light. And getting into the whole thing really begins by going back to 1971 when the Allman Brothers Band lost guitarist Dwayne Allman to a motorcycle accident, followed a year to the day later by losing Barry Oakley, the bassist, to another motorcycle accident. In this memoir, the rambling and rambunctious Greg Allman really lays himself bare, delving into his voracious appetite for drugs and sex, his broken relationships, addictions, and ultimately deep love for music. We also have The Receptionist, which has a subtitle, An Education at the New Yorker by Janet Groth. This is revelatory dispatches from Groth, who was for 21 years, from 1957 to 78, a receptionist at the New Yorker. And though she found mentors in the likes of John Berryman, Joseph Mitchell, and Muriel Spark, her subtext in what we think is a very rueful memoir is the question of why she didn't advance in these two tumultuous decades at the magazine. She had every intention and desire to come in as a receptionist, but move up into an editorial position, and that never happened. And then we have pop cultural icon Jay McInerney with The Juice, Venus Veritas. And we think he has the right swagger to inspire oneological pursuits in a less rarefied crowd. This is a collection of his wine columns from both House and Garden and the Wall Street Journal, where he demonstrates a welcome frankness that instills confidence in his choices, such as promoting lower-priced American brands next to Old World Masters. And his encounters with wines are deeply quirky, as always, such as when he called his first 1991 Clos Erasmus a sort of thinking man's fruit bomb.
A thinking man's fruit bomb.
Yeah. Sounds like it's an explosion in a glass.
I'm going to have to wrap my mind around what that is about. Well, listen, you not only have Jay McInerney on wine this week, but we have another author who is exploring the science of taste.
Yeah, that's right. It's in a book called Taste What You're Missing. Barb Stuckey explores the science of taste, as you say, with a lot of great DIY experiments, and you know, ultimately all to prove why good food tastes good. Among the some of her experiments is one that I like a lot, which is listening to the Who's Won't Get Fooled Again while drinking Chardonnay.
Well, we'll both have to try that and get back to the to the listeners on that. And from one drug to another.
Right. Well, we've got Pot Inc., where Greg Campbell is giving voice to both sides of the complex debate about legalizing marijuana, and provides a thoughtful meditation on the drug. This is, you know, much in the news lately, especially with California right now. He ultimately supports a nuanced acceptance of marijuana use. But he also holds the pro-pot advocates up to the journalistic microscope, highlighting the leadership squabbles, scandals, and some shady characters that are in the movement. And finally, in By Invitation Only, Alexis Maybank and Alexandra Wilkes Wilson, the founders of the high-end online outlet Guilt Group, which I do admit to using, recount their rise to success with what we say is an aim to empower entrepreneurs at every level, from brainstorming to business, to building a business. Guilt has seen phenomenal growth in a very short time, and of course spawned other sample cell sites like Outlook, and others seem to be coming out of the woodwork.
Well, from online shopping, which is a religion for some, and apparently even for Mike Harfke, on to religion as religion.
Yeah, we've got a starter view in this week's religion section, a couple, but the one I wanted to talk about was the tools, using the power within to connect to life-changing forces. This is by Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels, a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, respectively, who use deceptively potent visualization exercises to promote a streamlined method of self-improvement. And despite that focus, we say that ultimately this is a rare self-help book that doesn't end with the self. And finally, this week in the children's book reviews, I've got a few things that I love. There's a starter review of Dragons Love Tacos by Adam Rubin, which was illustrated by Daniel Salmieri. We call them two of the weirdest, funniest guys working in Kids Lit today. And this time out, they let their geek flag fly in an obsessive guide for would-be dragon taco party hosts. It's a lot of fun, and especially when spicy salsa gets into the tacos, the dragons will bring a whole new meaning to housewarming. And then a starter review of Beach Feet is in this week by Kiyomi Kanagaya, illustrated by Matsumitsu Saito, which is told in short, sweet, and staccato prose, and focuses on one child, one summer excursion, and one very particular set of feet. We think the artwork gives the pages a real sense of velvety luxury.
Pages of a children's book have velvety luxury, and I bet that was a phrase that Jay McInerney must have used to describe some wine, something with velvety luxury.
I bet you're right.
Mike Karfke, PW's deputy reviews editor, thanks so much for the review of the reviews.
Thank you.
And Andrew Albanese, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
It's good to have everybody here from Publishers Weekly. We'll tell everybody that Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.